Today is Saturday, July 16th, 2011. This is Jack Crawford at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm interviewing Olympic gold medal winner in the Dragon class keelboat, Gerald Schreck, over the phone today in order to record his experiences and reflections of the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. How are you doing today, Mr. Schreck?
I'm doing just fine, Jack. Thank you.
Great. Where are we talking to you from?
I am in Milton, Florida, at my daughter's house. I now live with her.
Nice. And so I understand you have a nickname. Is that right?
No, that's my real given name, Click.
Click?
C-L-I-C-K. Yeah, Click.
That's your given name, and but
yes.
Is that what you go by, or do you go by Gerald?
No, I go by Click.
Okay. All right, and so where were you born, Click?
I was born just 30 miles from here in Pensacola, Florida.
And when was that?
March 8, 1939.
And can you tell us anything about, I guess, your childhood or your early athletic pursuits?
Yes, my childhood was a very good childhood. My father was quite a bit older than me. He was born in 1894. He came to this country on a square rigger. He sailed around the Horn 12 times on a square rigger and was quite a man, and I was raised, he was pretty strict as a parent, but a very good and very loving parent, and I pretty much got to do what I wanted. He was very trusting and allowed me to go and do what I wanted as a young man, and I had always had a sailboat. My first sailboat was made by my older brother out of canvas, and I used to sail that in the bay in Pensacola. And then as I got a little older, 10 years old, I got my first Penguin. That was a little wooden competitive racing sailboat. And I raced it, and I've just been sailboat racing all my life. What else would you want to know? I had two brothers and three sisters, and my second oldest brother died at 25, and I was 8 years old when he died. And as of now, I have one sister left. All my other siblings are dead and gone. And I had a very wonderful childhood and with very good parents. I don't know what else I can add to it. I'm not very good at it.
So it sounds like you had sailing in your genes.
Yes, it did. On my mother's side, too, they were boat designers, and they came moved to Ingalls Shipyard from New York and worked in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And they designed and built boats, and the Starboat was one of them. And so I had boat designers and sailmaking. My father was a sailmaker from Germany, and that's where I learned the trade.
So what was it that started you getting, serious about competition?
Well, I always was. Ever since I was a kid, I was very serious. And when I graduated from high school in 57, I moved to New Orleans to work for my brother. And I worked for him for 2 years. And he moved over to Alabama, and I bought his business. And I was 19, and I it was all, I was into racing at the yacht club there. I had my Penguin, and I started making competitive racing sales. And Buddy and Bart and I got together because we sailed together every weekend, and I was the only sailmaker in town. And so I started designing racing sails. And Buster Curtis at Southern Yacht Club came to me and asked me if I would be interested in he's going to form an Olympic Sailing Association, and be interested in sailing. I'd been racing and sailing and winning races, and he picked out the three most competitive guys that he could think of at the yacht club, and that was Buddy Friedrichs and Barton and myself. And I made all the sails, did all the rigging and all of that stuff. And before the whole thing was over, the Olympics and everything, I was making about, I'd say 60% of the Dragon sales all over the world. 70% of my business was out of the country, and most of it was to Europe. Now, just kept improving on the sales. Just kept working on them. As a matter of fact, when we would go to the regattas, I would take extra sales because people would always want a suit, and they would doubt that I made all of them the same. So I was always swapping our sales out with somebody else's, so I could prove to them that I made them all the same. And did the same when went to the Olympics, but at the Olympics they wouldn't allow me to work on any of the competitive sales. So that was a different ball game. But all the other championships in sailing, I did. And I had several different type boats as a kid, a Dutchman, a Thistle, and stuff as a young man, and raced those competitively all over. And when we decided on a Dragon, an old friend of mine, Gene Honore, had an old Dragon that was about to sink, and we hauled it out, dried it out the best we could, and we sailed it in the 1964 North Americans. They were at New Orleans at Southern Yacht Club, and I made a new suit of sails for that. And Barton wasn't with us at that time, but we had Tom Dreyfus, and he sailed with us, and we took that old Dragon and had the Series 1 all the way up to the last race, when another local competitor, Gene Wallet, went on what we called a God Help Me in those days, and beat us. And when we did that, all the people knew that we were a group to be reckoned with, because that boat was in horrible shape, and all the boats we sailed against were all brand new, beautiful Dragons from all over the country in Canada. And we finished second in that, so by 1965, we had a new Dragon from Denmark, and we rigged it up, and I made all new sails, and we went out and won the North American Championships, and won every North American Championship up to the time we went to the Olympics, and then won the Worlds in 67, just before we went to the Olympics, and then won the Olympics in 68. But it was a long, long program. I mean, we sailed every evening. Guys, Barton and Buddy would come by the shop, because my shop was out right out by the yacht club where the boat was. I sailed off, and I'd always have new experimental sails, and we'd go try them and find out which one worked the best. And it was every day, and we would look for the days when it was really blowing hard, when nobody else would go out. Those were the days that we would go out and try our rig and our gear and sales and everything. And it was just, it was 4 years of hard work before we got to the Olympics. And the Olympic Sailing Association would send us, because we certainly couldn't afford it. They would send us to every regatta there was in the United States and in Europe. We went to Denmark and Germany and all of Canada and sailed in every regatta that was coming up in the Dragon class before the Olympics. So we were well prepared. Our hardest job in getting through the Olympics to win it was winning the Olympic trials in the United States, which was in Houston, Texas. And that was very, very hard, because my father died right in the middle of the Olympic trials, and I had to leave to come back to Pensacola to bury my daddy. And Buddy called his brother in to take my place, and I wasn't going to go back, but they called me and told me to come back, and I just buried my dad, and we spent all that time, and my mother told me to go ahead and go, and we had dropped from first to third, because we'd been sailing together as a team, and we knew how to do it, and Buddy's brother just hadn't had the experience and the timing and all the stuff that we had working as a team together. So we were in third place, and I went back, and we won the next two races, and that was enough for us to win the trials to represent the United States in the Olympics. And when we got to the Olympics, it was really pretty easy. We pretty much sailed against the Europeans and everybody else around the world. So the only challenge that we had in the Olympics was the Pacific Ocean and Acapulco, and that was because of the big swells. We just weren't really used to sailing anything like that. And the Olympic Committee sent a trials boat with us, one that we'd been sailing against, by a gentleman by the name of Chuck Colbert, who's a very fast boat. And for the first 2 weeks when we were up there, he had been sailing in the Pacific all of his life. He was going faster than we were, and was giving us fits, and I just happened to cut a little different jib, who was a jenny on a dragon because it overlapped with us, and we put it on and started using it, and we started going faster and faster and faster. About a second week, our trial boat that came with us, we were just destroying him, beating him unbelievable. And just walked away from him. So when it came time for the start of the Olympics, we were going so fast, it was absolutely no problem for us to win it. And we also had a jib adjustment that we called a Shrek haul. It was a little cross track that I designed with the way to adjust it up and down, so we could instantly change going up those big seas. We could bring it in and back, and going down the seas, we could let it out and forward, and it put us at a big advantage. We were the only one that had that type trim system and knew how to use it. And we were just going fast, very, very, very fast. There was nobody that could come close to us. And that's how we won the Olympics.
Very nice.
But that was 4 years of, I could go in and tell you every little day that we sailed, but we did every day at 4 o'clock in the evening. Every day we went out and sailed we ordered new masts, different masts. We were very fortunate to have the money from the Olympic Sailing Association to do what was needed to get what we needed. And we tried different lighter rigs. We tried some so light we had so many backstay that we couldn't keep the mast in the boat. It was just ridiculous. But we tried it. And then we got went so far as to get another boat, one built in the United States by Seville out in California. We drove out and picked it up and drove it back to New Orleans. So we had two boats to try against. And I'd sail one and Buddy would sail the other, and we'd get one going faster and get it going where it was going faster than the other one. Then we'd leave it just like it is, and then we'd make some changes, some sails, some trims and stuff in the other boat and get it going faster. And then we'd jump to the other boat and do the same thing over and over and over and over. We eventually had them both going as fast as they could possibly go. And we did every variable, every possible thing that we could think of to get the speed that was necessary to win. And besides that, we were young, we were hopped up, and full of energy. I mean, I ran my sail off all day long. I had 13 employees and worked in there. And then every evening went out sailing. And then when I went home, I had 5 kids. I started a family at a very young age. And so it was a lot of work. And Buddy was a stockbroker. And Barton worked for a shipping firm. They both had very, very busy schedules, but we made it, and their businesses allowed them to get off so we could go. They knew what it was for us to go practice, so we were able to do what we wanted to do. We had the help of a lot of people, which could not have been done without them. No way it would have come up, because had to have the time off to practice, and if you didn't have a boss that was willing to let you do that, you couldn't do it. I was my own boss, and I was lucky, but it just required a lot of extra work, a lot of hardship. But that's what it's all about.
Can you take me back to that first race? You mentioned that the challenger did a God help me. Can you explain to me what that is?
Yeah, that was Gene Wilder. That's what we called. That was in the first Dragon series that we sailed in. It was going in the last race, and we were ahead in the series, and he was way, way behind, going to the last mark, the finish line, And there was no place for him to go but way, way off to the other side of the course where nobody was at. And he tacked over there, and there was nothing there. That's why we didn't go there. But the breeze filled in from where he was, and he came flying down out of nowhere. So we were becalmed along with about 10 or 12 other boats, and there were just enough boats over there with him, 4 or 5 of them, that by him being the first one to finish out of that God help me group and come down, he finished first, and we ended up finishing about 8th or something like that, and that was just enough that we didn't win the trials there in New Orleans. And we did not, none of us sailed dragons up to that time. None of us raced a dragon. I sailed with everybody every weekend, all my customers in different boats, but mainly I sailed a looter, and Barton sailed a looter, and Buddy sailed a looter. We all raced looters, and that was a keelboat, too. But the dragon was just, we didn't really race them because we didn't have, the competition was not that good at our dragon class at Southern Yacht Club that we wanted to go out and sail against them because we felt like we could beat them any time. And until they had that North, the Olympic trials come there, did we decide to sail a dragon, and that's when I borrowed that old sinking dragon, and it was sinking. I'm telling you, it stayed full of water. We had to dry it out and caulk it, and all the other boats were beautiful. It was a mess, but we got it together enough that we went out and we were winning that regatta. But we were just a young bunch of good sailors, and we got together and we had what it take, the perseverance to just keep going, you know, because it's easy to get tired doing all that every day, and then you had to leave your family and go to all these different regattas all across the country and all across the United States. But we did it. I couldn't do it now. I couldn't even think about doing it now. I have a hard time just walking around.
Now, some of many of the other athletes that were competing in Mexico City, they had to worry about the altitude and the training for the altitude. Now, what was your location? You said it was in Acapulco?
Yes. And we had to worry about the heat.
The heat.
And Montezuma's Revenge. I got sick the first day we got to Acapulco. I was in bed for 4 days. We and the heat really messed up the Scandinavians. They had a hard time with the heat. A lot of them got hospitalized, but they had a really good medical staff there. And I was in bed for 3 or 4 days, and they came in and checked on me constantly. It was a good thing it was a little small bathroom, because I could sit on the head and be able to throw up in the sink at the same time. But they told us not to drink any water or to do anything on the way down there, but I don't know how you drive that far all the way through. We went up to Mexico City and got our luggage and our uniforms and our dress uniforms for the opening ceremony, and they gave you everything you could think of. That you had shoes and hats and shorts and bathing suits and everything you needed. And we got that, and then we drove down to Acapulco. But it was hot, but we were used to the heat. And the poor Scandinavians were not. It was harder on them than it was us. So a lot of them did get sick longer than I was. Some of them were even hospitalized.
What were your impressions of Mexico City?
Well, that was right after they had getting into Mexico City. Mexico City is dirty, and it was polluted back then. That's in 68. And driving up to the Olympic Village, getting to the Olympic Village, there were machine gun guards all along the side of the road. And that's where they just had a big problem with all the young students there. So that was kind of on edge business. Made you a little bit nervous seeing all that. But when we got into the Olympic Village, it was very nice. The rooms were nice. The food was great. and the people were very nice and efficient. We liked it. We got along. We met the girls' dad and team, and that's the first. We only stayed there one day, and that was who we spent the most of the time with while we were there. Was the young pretty girls. But it was okay. It was just a shame they had all that trouble back then, and that was when a lot of turmoil was going on. I'm trying to remember the young black guy, the runner that held his fist up in defiance of the United States when he got his gold medal. I can't remember his name now. But,
yeah, that was Smith and Carlos, and I would like to get back to that and ask you a question about that in a little bit. Do you remember, did you hear anything about, there was a student massacre that I guess was the reason for all of that extra security. Do you remember hearing anything about that while you were there?
Not at the Olympic Village, no. I heard about it before we left to go down there. We heard about it. But at the Olympic Village, no. Not a word, not that I remember. I heard something when we got to Acapulco from different people there. It's so far back, I can't remember what, but that's exactly what it was. And we did hear more about it because when we got there, they assigned a student to each one of us. Well, actually, three that stayed with us that spoke all the different languages so we could communicate with everybody. And that's who found out most about it was the young students that they assigned to us while we were there. And
yeah.
They told us about it. I don't know the details of it because actually when you're there with what we were doing, our minds were so completely, totally occupied on the series coming up and the race and then winning, we really just completely tuned out everything. I don't know if you can understand that, but you get in that type phase where you just tune out all everything else around you that's happening, and you're only thinking of sailing the boat and going fast and winning the gold medal, and that's all we had on our mind. And it was a lot more pressure on me because I had all the people. I made probably 60% of the sales there. The ones that didn't have my sales had copies of mine because I'd have people order sales without numbers and stuff. And they would have their sale maker in France and Germany and different places take them apart to copy them for the Olympics so they could put their home country sale thing on it. Had quite a bit of that. But I was fixing their sales and doing what they wanted done, and they were bringing them to me. And then Paul Smart, our team captain, came to me and told me, he says, "You are forbidden to work on any competitor's sales." He says, "I hate to tell you this, Mr. Shrek." He says, "I'm sorry." He says, "I know it's your business that you make all these sales." He says, "But you cannot work on them while you represent the United States in the Olympics." So that I had to tell those people that, but I did go in. They had a sail off set up there where they had some different little sail makers there that I knew, little guys. And I'd go into them and tell them what it needed to be done on the sail and to do it for the competitors. But I could no longer really do it. Paul Smart put a stop in a hurry because I very couldn't tell him what was wrong if I didn't put the sail and go out with him on the boat. He wouldn't allow me to do that. So I didn't get a chance to work on the competitor sail, which I did on all the other regattas all across Europe and Canada and everything. I always took a sewing machine with me every time we went to a regatta because I would always have somebody that would want something done or some little something. And it was not a complete exact scientist. I had different seamstresses sewing, and they could get one little seam just a 64th of an inch off or less than that, and it would make a little difference in what the sail looked like. So I would always take what I needed to correct any problems that anybody had with the sails when they got them. Most of it was psychological. If you just ripped a little something out and did a little something on a sail, it made them happy and they felt good. Because sailors, it's mostly a mind game with them. They have to feel that their sail is perfect. That's why we swap sails out. I would actually take our numbers off of our sails and stick their numbers on and give them our sails because they swore that I made the sales better for us than I did for them, and we'd take their sales. But that's human nature.
Yeah.
I got used to that for a while. It didn't bother me.
So
I made them up. Go ahead.
When you were in Mexico City, did you attend the opening ceremony?
Yes, I did. Yes, they flew us up there. We had the Hala and some boxers and a bunch of other people that were staying at the headquarters they set up for us. And then we got in our dress uniform that they provided us. They told us what to do. And we went to the airport right there in Acapulco. They flew us right up to Mexico City and took us in a bus right out to the opening ceremony. The opening ceremony was quite impressive. It really was. And then we marched in that, and that was the first time when I noticed there was any bad display of behavior how the blacks felt. I didn't even think anything of it when they started acting up at the ceremony and showing their butts. And I just couldn't believe anybody would be acting like that, but they did. But they quieted it down and let them know you won't be in the opening ceremony if you don't behave. And we got in. It was a big group of us, and we marched around the whole thing, and it was packed, and they released all the birds, doves, and the doves poopty-dooed all over everybody. But it was quite impressive. I enjoyed it very much. I was very glad we got to go to the opening ceremony.
Did you know anything about the Harvard crew? They sent out a letter about supporting the black athletes. Did you ever see that or hear anything about it?
No, I did not. No. No. Really, like I told you, we really didn't know too much about it. Anything until after we really got down into Acapulco. I know it was a big shock when they talked about you, the gentleman that you told me, Carlos, when we were in Acapulco, and then the young students knew about the killing of all those young college students that went on. And like you said, the word massacre, I mean, that's how they described it, and that's how everybody thought it was. But that was very unnerving. That really just didn't make you feel comfortable. You didn't feel comfortable. You think that somebody would shoot a bunch of students. And but then nowadays we're seeing it all over the world right now. So. It was horrible.
So Smith and Carlos, they had already finished their event and they did their Black Power salute before you started your event?
I think before we finished our event.
Okay.
Our event went on for quite a while. If I'm not mistaken, it was pretty much towards the end of our event when we started hearing Smith and Carlos. I remembered Carlos. I didn't remember Smith. But I didn't really get to see any of it or anything about it till I got back home on television. But did hear about it. It did come down to the yacht club in Acapulco and the hotel where they had us at. Heard about it. But that's all.
Yeah.
We were not well informed, and I imagine that probably purposely. I don't think they would have probably told us everything anyway. You know, only what got out. They didn't keep us too well informed. Like I told you, Paul Spar wouldn't allow me to go work on those sales, which I thought was horrible. I just didn't know what to tell those people that I made your sales and I'm not allowed to work on them. But they accepted it and they seemed to understand. And I did not mind walking with them over to the sale off and tell the guy what to do, what I thought they needed to help them. So I didn't have anybody upset and mad at me, which I was happy about because they were nice enough to order their sales from me from another country. That was good, and I did. At that time, I was doing 85% of my business out of the country and my sale off out of New Orleans. And that was all because of all the regattas and that we had won and all over the world. And so it doesn't take long, and the Europeans, they hear about something fast, they want it immediately. I made sales, who's still a good friend of mine, and I got Carlos Palm. I made sales for Juan Carlos, who was the Prince of Spain at that time. Now he's the King of Spain. I made all his sales, and I made his brother-in-law, who was King Constantine, who was the King of Greece at that time. I made all his sales and corresponded with both of them. I still have those letters to this day. We corresponded back and forth, and I called him Juan Carlos, and he called me Click. and we got along very, very good. I sent him first suit of sails. He won the Princess Sophie trophy with. That was his wife's trophy. It was a princess at the time, and they had a trophy, and he won the first one, and he contributed it all to the sales I made him. He wrote me very nice letters. We corresponded for years and years and years. And he's 1 year older than me. He's 74 now. I'm 73 now. I'm 72.
Very nice. So you interacted with your competitors, the sailing competitors, and were any of them like Soviet bloc athletes or like the GDR, the German athletes?
Yes. The ones that finished third were right next to us was the East Germans. They were in the Soviet bloc. They were a very nice guy. Matter of fact, I'm looking at their picture now. And the Danes were second, got the silver medal from Denmark. They were always, they dominated the Dragon class for 50 years, whatever it was, in Europe and everywhere, the Danes did. But the East German team, I did some work for them, and I did some work for the Chinese. I brought all, when I went up there, I brought all my sledging equipment and st- stuff like that, and they had some running backstays, and they wanted to they knew I was a sailmaker, and they wanted to me to splice the wire for them by hand. It was quite a job on a little small wire, and I took out my little Nico tool and my little fittings and my wire cutters, and I cut it, and I Nicoed it for them, showed it to them. They were just amazed. They couldn't believe that I could fix that for them that quick, and they were just as happy. So we got along real good. And then the Orientals had my sails. They bought a buddy's boat that sailed in New Orleans with us against us, Roy Trundle's boat, and it had all my sails on it. And I showed them how to bend the rig, get the rig flexible, bend it, and to make it go. They were very happy, very nice. They were moored. Well, we came out of the water every day, but they were in their boat trailer right next to us each day, so we talked back and forth, which was kind of hard because they didn't speak very much English, and we certainly didn't speak any Chinese. But we had translators. So we got along very, very good with everybody. At least I did. I liked everybody. I enjoyed it. My father, I wish he was there. My father spoke seven languages, and that's the one that sailed around the world on the square riggers. But I couldn't even speak Spanish.
So did politics of the Cold War or anything like that enter any of the interactions?
Did it what?
Did it influence or affect any of your, you know, relations with some of the other athletes?
No, no, I don't think so. At least it didn't with me. I can't speak for how Buddy and Martin talked about it, but it didn't bother me a bit. I mean, these guys, especially these guys, we used Germany, and my father was from East Germany, Zerbsteinhau. And I didn't even think about it, really, to be honest with you, about any of those problems. That's what I think is good about the Olympics, and people get that kind of politics and that crap out of their minds and think about the real world and what's really happening and what's good, what it's all about. Thoughts didn't see it from anybody else, and thoughts never crossed my mind. The only politics I saw really in all my experience doing all that sailing was in Holland, sailing in Holland when an Irish and an Englishman were catching each other's line when we were getting towed out of the harbor, and the Irishman threw his line to the Englishman on his boat, and he missed it, and he claimed he did it on purpose, and he went running across boats and jumped from one boat to the other, and they had a fist fight right there. But I didn't realize how much hate was going on then between England and Ireland at that time, but it was. But that's the only uproar, or whatever you'd call it, that I saw in all those years of sailing all over the world.
Now, in 1968 was sort of a pivotal time. They started testing for banned and performance-enhancing substances. Did you get tested, or did you see any of that going on?
The only thing I saw that was going on in 1968, which I heard after a village, was they were checking and had found some of the Soviet women were not women. They were men that had had a sex change operation. And that was a fact.
Wow.
That was, yes, you can check that. As a matter of fact, they had a quiz program or something on it like that. One of the questions was that, and I answered that, and my daughter says, "How did you know that, Daddy?" I said, "Because they were finding sex change for the 68 Olympics, making men so they would be women in the track and field." And that was in 68. That was the only thing that I knew that got everybody a little uptight. I'm sure there's more, but like I told you, you know, you when you're there and you, this is the last hoo-ha, and you got to have everything ready. You're pretty much tuned out to everything that's going on around you. If you were there to see the event and enjoy it and things like that, you would pick up the gossip and probably talk with it and learn a lot more than what I did. Because I had just one thing on my mind, and that was winning the Olympics. And that was it. But I'm sure there was a lot of it going on, especially with the deal with Carlos. The black guy, and Smith, and then the Russian thing. But those are the only two things I heard of, and not much, not a lot.
Yeah.
Hugh O'Brien, the movie actor, came to where we were and sat down with us at the table. He heard about it. He was trying to make a little something out of it, and I, at that time, I really didn't. That could have been where I first heard about it. I did down in Mexico, and that might have been right after we won, the day after we won. I don't know, but I think that's where it came from. But it was there, and I just didn't pay a lot of attention to what was.
Do you recall?
I respect.
Yeah. Do you recall if they let those Russian athletes compete, or was that a...
No, I don't think they did. Hmm. I don't think they did. You could probably do some research on that and find out about it. You didn't know about it?
No, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, you could probably do some research because it was on a program. It was over the radio, yes. One of those things where they asked the different questions. What was that? So-and-so in the 1968 Olympics, and one of the things was a sex change operation, and that's what it was. And the research would be there. You can find that out. I don't think they allowed them to compete. But like same thing like the black athlete, I didn't pay a whole hell of a lot of attention to that either. But it did go on, and we knew about it.
So did you attend the closing ceremony as well?
What you mean, after the Olympics?
Yes.
No, did not. We were told we could. They would have taken care of and got us up there. I did not. We all had to get back to our businesses and everything that went on, and Barton had to go out of the country for Likes Brothers steamship, so he flew back, and Buddy and I drove the boat back to New Orleans and drove nonstop Acapulco, New Orleans. The only time we'd use the bathroom or get something to eat is while the car was being filled up with gas. That was unbelievable. Of course, we'd made trips all over the United States and the world with towing a dragon, and we were quite good at it at that time. We did burn up a bunch of brand new automobiles because Buddy had such a heavy foot. When he'd get his chance to drive, he drove too hard. When we had Buick and Oldsmobile dealerships giving us new cars every time we'd go on a trip anywhere, and we burned up one Oldsmobile going to Texas, or from New Orleans before we got over in Texas.
So when they gave you the cars, was that like a sponsorship deal, or
how? It was so they could advertise and say that they didn't give them to them. They lent us to them to tow the boat. We went and got the hitches and everything put on, so they could, for their advertising, that they did that for the Olympic Sailing Association. So we got the new cars to take on every trip that we went on. And it was good because we needed them. That drag was heavy.
Yeah. There was some tension at that time as well between amateurism and professional athletes, with, like, you know, athletes being paid or sponsored and those sorts of things. Do you remember any of those issues?
Not really. I know that now, nowadays, that if I sail because I'm a sailmaker, and they say I'm a professional, but yet all the sailmakers are sailing in the Olympics. I don't know. They say you're allowed only. So if you're a boat builder or a sailmaker and you sail, the only two of y'all can be on there, but they still let you go to the Olympics. And no, we didn't have any problem. I'm sure it was starting and going on then.
I heard a rumor or something about some shoes, like Docksiders or something.
Topsiders, you mean?
Yeah, Topsiders. Do you remember anything about that?
No, I do not. I certainly don't. I sold Topsiders at my business in New Orleans at my sail off. I was the first Topsider dealer in New Orleans. No, I don't remember anything like that. What was the question too? That they were too good or too bad or?
No, I think I heard that somebody tried to give the team a set of Topsiders, and the Olympics wouldn't let you accept them, or something along those lines.
What they do, and they still do it. They give one company that sponsors everything for the Olympian when they go. It's like the year in '68 when we went, it was Sears. Sears did our luggage. Sears did our clothes. Sears did our undershorts, our T-shirts, our dress shirts, our ties, our belts, shoes. We had our own sailing shoes, but and everybody had Topsiders. I mean, of course, I sold them. That's why we all had Topsiders. I sold them out of my loft. But Sears and Roebuck that year did it all, and then a buddy of mine just went to the Olympics in China, and he was a young kid. He used to work for me. Now he's a big multi-billionaire. He owns Trinity Yachts. And he was the oldest one there. He was well in his late 50s. And it was some other company. He told me that gave all their blazers and their dress things and their uniforms and their luggage and all that. It was a different company, but that's what happens every 4 years. Some they bid for it, and some company gets the okay from the Olympic Committee, and then they furnish everything. No, I didn't know anything about topsiders. But certainly everybody and anybody that was sailing all had topsiders. Who's the best boat shoe? Halb still is. They have dockers that are pretty good now, but topsider was always our choice. And we wore the leather moccasins. No, I didn't know anything about that.
So, do you have any advice for Olympic hopefuls?
Well, back then, and when it was easy to go, and now it's even harder. You have to have some sort of sponsorship if you are good and you're competitive and you want to compete in a sport. You have to have, number one, some financing. I don't care how good you are or what, if you don't get sponsored with the money to go to the events before the Olympics themselves and be able to afford to do it and spend the time that you need to do it. In this country, it's hard. We're not professionals. Other countries, they're already need you to take care of your family and do everything else, and then all you are is training for the Olympics. In this country, you still have to make a living. And even if you're a young kid and your family are taking care of you, you still need some financial aid because most families can't afford it. All Olympians do not come from wealthy families. And it takes a lot of money. That's the number one thing I would say to a young hopeful. If he's got the talent and knows he's got that talent and has that competitive spirit and wants to win, then he can has to look forward to getting some sort of financial help, because he could not go if he didn't have it. And that would be the number one thing. First off, if you're thinking of being an Olympic hopeful, that means you're very good at what you're getting into in the first place. And if you got the financing and you get to go to some of those events, you'll find out real quick what you're made of and if you have the stick and power to continue on and go any further, because it gets hard. I don't care what you're in, even if you were bowling, it takes dedication and perseverance and time and money, and you got to have all of those. You can't be without one of them. You got to have every one of them if you want to be an Olympian. That's really about all I could say.
Very good.
And,
so
I hope it is. I hope it helps you.
Yeah, yeah. When you finished the Olympics, sounds like you didn't have much in the way of downtime. Is that right? Did you go directly back to work?
Yes, I did. I went back to work, and I was very, 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 very busy. I started doing bigger boat sales, and as a matter of fact, in 1973, a man came to me, a good friend of mine. He's still alive. He's 87 or 88 right now. I'm going to go over and visit him next week. Bought a boat and wanted me to sail it the Southern Ocean Racing Circuit. And that was the year all the greats were there from all over the world. Turner was there. Hood was there. Dennis Conner was there. Every great ocean sailor in the world was there. And he got a little Gary Mull designed Moon Yakita. I ordered it for him. It was not a custom boat. It was a production boat that was made. And I picked the crew out, and we went to St. Petersburg, where it started at the SORC, and we won all six races, the longest race being 465 miles. We won all six of them and won the overall SORC on this boat. First time and only time it's ever been done. And they've changed the SORC now, so it'll never be done again. But I won every one of the races. And I was busy in that, and that kept me busy in making big boat sails. And I'll give you an idea. Our little boat cost $35,000. And Ted Turner's boat, who's exactly the same class as ours, was $285,000. So, wow. The big difference in money. And we took the poor boys' team and went to the Southern Ocean Racing Circuit and won all six races. So, that was my next busy thing after the Olympics. I said I wouldn't do it anymore after the Olympics, but I geared up for this one thing and picked a good crew and got all the young guys, and we went down there and won it. I also put that same trim thing, the Shrek hauler that we used on the Dragon, I put that into use on the Moon Yukita, the Ranger One Ton, the 37-foot boat that we went on the SORC, and I put that into use on there, and I contribute that to a lot of the winning that we did. That was last time. After that, I haven't competitively really raced anymore. I don't feel like getting geared up like that. It takes a lot out of you.
Yeah.
It really does. I mean, you don't think so. Well, you think, well, you're having fun and you're doing this. Mentally, it melts you down. It really does. Sailing is all mental anyway. I mean, no, it's a lot. It's physical. You got to be good. You got to be in good shape, especially if you're offshore racing. And it's hard and heavy, heavy seas, and big winds, all that. It's hard, but it's mostly mental. It really is. It can drain you.
Yeah, I forgot to ask earlier, what was your position on the boat? Like, did you have a particular task? Or...
I trimmed all the sails up when Martin just crossed from side to side, and Buddy and I handled the cockpit. I trimmed all the sails. I trimmed the main for Buddy. I trimmed the jenny, used my Shrek hauler in and out, and I tacked the sails from side to side. And since I was most agile and the strongest, I also went forward and set the chute, put the chute up, and then I came back and trimmed the chute. But I did all sail trimming of all three sails at all times.
Very nice.
I was young, strong, and agile. And I was a sailmaker, and I made the sails, so I knew how they were supposed to be flown, too. That helped.
Yeah, and so this the Shrek collar, is that in wide use today?
They have different boats that have different tracks systems where they can go. It allows you to go in and outboard with the lead or inboard with the lead, and it allows you to go fore and aft. It had a little cross track instead of going to a long track like all the other Dragons had. I had just one little cross track, and on that cross track, I had a little car that could slide in and out, and that track went the width of the deck out, so I could go all the way out. And I would have a block that ran through there on a line that came inside the cockpit, so I could instantly go fore and aft by letting that up or down. I could move the lead back or move the lead forward. If I pulled it down, I moved the lead forward. And I had it set at the max distance down forward for the sails. So all I had to do was pull it all the way down or let it up, and that would move me fore and aft. And then by letting it go, it would go outboard on the lead and let it go out. And it was done, and I controlled all that from inside the cockpit. On the Munyakita, I did two parallel tracks because that Jenny was too big to handle, and we weren't down below doing it. Two parallel tracks, two blocks that I could pull fore and aft, and two leads on the Jenny. So I let one go and pull the other one out, let the out one go, pull the other one in. So I could change the lead in and out and pour it aft on the Munyakita. That was a big boat. But it was just a bigger, heavier boat and a lot more, tremendous amount more sail. And so it had to be done on great big winches, done that way, but it worked. We were the only one with it, and it worked very good. And, yeah, boats have it. Boats use it. They have ways of doing that.
So we can add the invention to your list of accomplishments.
Yeah, well, Graham Hall wrote an article. I forget what year it was, but it was in Yachting Magazine. And he wrote for Yachting for a long time, and he wrote an article on it, the Shrek Harla. And he had pictures and all that in the magazine way back when. I can't remember. That was when we were training and had people. He was one that came down from New York and moved down here just to sail against us. He had a dragon, and he wanted to be able to beat us. And so he sailed against us. We became very, very good friends. Matter of fact, his wife worked for me for a little while. And he wrote an article about the Shrek Crawler, and matter of fact, he was the one that named it in Yachting Magazine. Had pictures and everything of it, and it was nice of him to do that. He was a nice young man.
So
that's it.
Okay. Well, what do you think of our project? What does the preservation of the 1968 U.S. team legacy mean to you?
Well, it's I'm very, 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 very proud. You're talking about our deal?
Yeah.
I'm very proud, and meet people, and my daughter's always telling them, well, my daddy won an Olympic gold medal, and people just don't believe it, you know. It's something I'll take all the way to my death. Very, very proud. The proudest and the most that I felt about it is when they played our national anthem in Mexico, and we stood at in the center and got our medal put around our neck. That was when I realized what a big deal it was. And the Danes were to our left, and the East Germans were to our right. And it was nice. I'll never forget it. That was more exciting than the ceremony. That was more exciting. I think that's when it all came together. Your face gets a little flush, and you can feel the blood and in your temples. And I still feel that feeling every once in a while. It comes back, and I still have little dreams about it. All of us up there and winning it, still comes back in my mind, so I'm not dead yet.
Far from it.
I have the feelings.
Is there anything else that you think is important that you'd like to tell us, or?
Not really, nothing I can think of, but feel free to call if there's something when you put it together that you want to know or what have you. But it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience, the most wonderful experience of my lifetime. And I've had 5 kids and 11 grandkids, and I have 3 great grandkids and another great grandkid on the way, and I love them all, and I think it's wonderful. But nothing beats that Olympic challenge, and especially winning the Olympics. It goes to the top of the list. It really does, and I say that because so much emphasis is put on it, and you're sailing against the very best in the world, and you know if you win this, you have just beat everybody in the world, and that's what makes it so good. I mean, you can win one of your regattas or something here, but when you sail one, you got the best of everybody in the world. That registers home. It's a wonderful feeling. It really is.
Well,
that's about it.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
You're quite welcome, and please feel free to call me, Jack.
Okay. This has been Click Schreck, gold medal winner of the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. And this has been a recording of his experiences and reflections.